Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good evening and welcome. And my name is Nigella Hilgarth, and I'm the Executive Director of the Birch Aquarium at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. And it's my great pleasure this evening to welcome you to the latest Jeffrey B. Graham Perspectives on Ocean Science lecture, and to introduce Dr. Greg Rouse. Greg, as many of you will know, is from Australia. And I hesitate to say born and raised in Australia, because whenever I say something like that, people come up to me afterwards and say, actually, no, I was born somewhere else. So I didn't check with him. But he did his bachelor's and his master's at the University of Queensland, and then he did his PhD in zoology at the University of Sydney. And then he came to the States, to the Smithsonian, and did a postdoctoral from 1991 to 1994. And then after that, he had several research appointments back in Australia. And then we were lucky enough in 2006 to get him to come here to Scripps Institution of Oceanography as a professor, but also as the curator of our wonderful invertebrate collection. And you may not know that we have some incredible collections of ocean organisms here at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and the invertebrate collection is really spectacular, and we're very lucky to have Greg to be the curator of that. He also does a lot of research, has written in a large number of papers and book chapters and even some books, and I don't have time to tell you about them all, just to say that in summary, he is very interested in invertebrates, particularly marine invertebrates, especially worms. Now, that may not sound very exciting to you, but I think you'll be blown away by how absolutely beautiful and amazing a lot of marine worms actually are. They're incredibly diverse and exciting. And so, without further ado, I'm going to ask him to talk about new discoveries in deep-sea animal diversity.
Well, thank you very much for coming. Thanks to Nigella, and thanks for having me speak to you. I will try and persuade you that worms are very exciting and very cool. And if you've been sitting here for the last 20 minutes waiting for me to start, you've been watching an amazing video from 1,800 meters in Monterey Canyon, just north of us here. And what you've been seeing is a whale carcass that's being investigated by a remote operated vehicle, or I'll usually use the acronym ROV. And that's one of Monterey Bay Aquarium and Research Institute's ROVs, whom I work very closely with. And one of the themes that will come through in tonight's talk is collaboration among different people. So I work with a variety of people who I'll try and mention and give credit to through the course of the talk. And we will definitely revisit this whale carcass as time goes on. But what I'd like to touch on first is actually some history of the exploration of the deep. And that's what I'll talk about initially as to how we developed the technology that we use today in terms of collecting specimens and why there was the goal to go down there and actually get specimens in much better condition. And then I'll briefly review what we do know, and actually I'll highlight what we don't know, which is how little of the deep sea we have explored and how much more we have yet to do. And then I want to talk about three places that I've directly worked with, and I'll tease out from each one of those places a story about animal diversity, focusing on some new species that we've found, and in some cases just show you, literally this just happened in February, March, some of the things that we think we're going to find and some of the research goals. So it's an ongoing process. But some of the stories are wrapping up now, and I can tell you some of the interesting things that we found. So that'll be, first I'll start off with, and I'll go back to those whale falls that I was talking about, and I'll tell you what whale falls are and why they're important biologically. And then I'll talk briefly about something called carbonate methane seeps, and these are methane seep, some of you might have heard of, but most of you probably haven't heard of a carbonate methane seep because they've hardly been studied, and we've done one of the first expeditions to them early this year. And that's with Lisa Levin, who's one of the biological oceanographers here at Scripps. And then I'll wrap up with a project that I've been doing in association with a postdoc of mine, Karen Osborne, in my lab, on some bizarre deep pelagic animals. And while Nigella was certainly correct in stating that most of these stories concern worms, particularly on the whale falls and the deep pelagic, the methane seep thing is much more diverse in that we're really trying to understand all of the different creatures that are there. And then I'll finish with a brief outline of our collections and a pitch for the importance of collections and particularly our collection here at Scripps. Okay, for many of you, this might be old hat. You might already know it, but for some of you, it might be new. So I just want to run through some of the history of how we got to being able to use these amazing submersibles to go down and collect these animals in such beautiful condition. And back in the mid-19th century, we had this idea that the deep sea below 500 meters, was essentially sterile. And this came from some initial observations in the Mediterranean. But then Michael Sars, who was working also with his father or his son, I can't quite remember, were working off Norway, and they managed to develop technology to send a dredge down 1,000 meters and came up with this extraordinary find. It was really one of the biological finds of last century, and any of you who are interested in fossils might well know that this is a sea lily. And they actually dominate the central part of the US. Through Illinois, you can go everywhere and you'll see crinoid fossils. And to find a living one of these was truly a wonderful discovery. And suddenly the deep sea was alive and there were things down there that we didn't know about. And so deep sea expeditions began to kick in. And the most famous of these is the Challenger expedition that ran from 1872 to 1876. Now, underlying this, there's always a subtext, and if I was a political historian or something, I'd be talking to you about colonialism and how this was extending Britain's reach over the globe. But as I'm talking about science, I'll just talk about what they actually collected. So the red track is where they went. They went around the world and over 127,000 kilometres of journeying. And in the course of this, they published a multi-series volumes of books that were the resulted in the taxonomic description of over 4,500 new species. So it was a spectacular success in terms of finding new deep sea life. Now there's a big challenge in getting this kind of equipment down. So this is a various kinds of dredges that were used on the Challenger. I'll just highlight that if you want to look at the actual volumes, you can go to that website. If you just look up HMS Challenger Expedition, 19th century, there is a link, and the British government's made all of their volumes, and there are, it's thousands and thousands of pages online with all of the plates, and it's really worth a look. And it has actually this picture, which is some of their dredges that they used, and they have a bag here to actually pick up something, but also a trailing set of knotted ropes that would also pick up some of the animals down there. But it's a big challenge to get down a wire or a piece of rope, usually when you're really deep, you need to send down wire, and to know that you've actually hit the bottom. So you have to really develop the technology to know that you're hitting the bottom, that you when you're pulling it up, you're actually going to have something at the end. And over trial and error, they managed to develop these techniques to have great success in pulling up from depths of over 4,000 meters deep. The trouble was that the specimens, when they came up, had often been jammed together in these bags, broken, smashed, almost certainly always dead, and we really had to infer a lot of the observations about these animals from very badly damaged specimens. So one of the first people to really try and get over this was William Beebe, and he developed this bathysphere, which was basically a sphere on a cable. It had no power or propulsion, but it was just lowered over the side of the ship. And I have to say these were definitely brave men indeed. When you look at the diameter of the thing, it was very small. They had a lead seal, so they actually went inside and then screwed the thing on, and it was the lead seal that prevented the water going in, and then it was unscrewed to let them back out. These guys were really the rock stars of the 1930s, or the astronauts of the 1930s. They were they had on the cable a radio, a microphone line, so they were actually able to talk to the service and broadcast all over the US. So they were having live interviews while they were down there. So they were, it was an incredibly big boost for deep sea research. They couldn't collect anything, and there's the space was incredibly confined, but they did actually get down to depths of over 1,000 meters and were able to look out and see life outside. And so there's a marvelous book called Half a Mile Down, if you're interested in reading about the history of this. The next phase, though, was to start going deeper and deeper. And this was developed by André Picard in the 1950s, who transferred the ownership of this to the US Navy in 1958. And this vast vessel here was actually the actual mechanism to go down and to come up. The two men who were in the vessel actually went in through here and down there and were in this sphere at the base. This was actually full of ballast and gasoline to provide buoyancy once they came up, and otherwise was full of large amounts of iron shot that they dropped when they wanted to come up, and then the gasoline took them back up to the surface. So using the Trieste, Jacques Picard, André's son, and a US Navy officer, Don Walsh, went down to the Challenger Deep in 1960. So that's the deepest part of the ocean over the whole world. It's about 11,000 meters down. And that's right over here near the Mariana Trench, near the Philippines. So they went down to the bottom and they did see life at the bottom of this Mariana Trench. And amazingly, no one has been back ever. We have sent back, the Japanese sent back their remote operated vehicle, their ROV Keiko in 1998. And just recently, a very newly developed AUV, autonomous underwater vehicle, called Nereus, which can also be an ROV, it can be operated by a cable, did go back down to the bottom of the Challenger Deep. But it brings up an interesting point that more people have been to the moon and walked on the moon, 12, than have been to the deepest part of the ocean, 2. Some people question the need for us to go back to the deepest parts of the ocean because it really is a very small part of the overall sea. But I say this to highlight, actually, that we've visited very few parts of the deep sea in general. And while that particular place might not be of that much interest, there are certainly many other places that we should be exploring. So what has been done in terms of exploration, and the one vessel I do want to highlight, among others, is Alvin, which I'm sure many of you have heard of. Commissioned in 1964, still diving 45 years later, Alvin's done over 4,500 dives now and still counting, and can operate down to about 4,500 meters. So it doesn't go to the deepest depths of the ocean, but it does go to about the average depth of the ocean. So on average, the ocean is about 4,000 meters. So Alvin is capable of handling most of the habitats in the sea, but it can't do the deep trenches. And I'll tell you a little bit about Alvin later on. Today, though, we have a number of other submersibles that people can go in, such as the French Nautile, which can go to 6,000, the Japanese Shinkai, which can go, it's the deepest rated vessel, to 6,500, and the Russians have two, Mir 1 and Mir 2. And additionally, there are hundreds of ROVs now available that are used to mainly maintain oil platforms that the oil industry is using. But more and more scientists are using these ROVs as well because they're logistically easier to manage, you need less crew, and of course they're safer, although there's never been really an accident. Well, there's been one accident with a sub, but I won't bore you with that. So what I do want to tell you a few things about the deep, though, before I carry on. The first one is, though, that, as I pointed out, the deepest part, the Challenger Deep, is 11,000 metres. The average depth of the sea, though, is this vast area called the Abyssal Plain, which runs for on average about 4,000 meters, and really is very much unexplored. The traditional view of the deep sea, though, is this vast unending plain of mud, which as we do start to explore more and more, we're finding is really not the case. So in 1970, this is what you would read if you read about, well, what is the deep sea? It's this vast unending plain. But now we are finding even this vast unending plain does have variety. It has different kinds of organisms, such as amazing protozoans. It has strange ripples and burrows. There can be vast areas of bacterial mats. and vast areas of plankton that has fallen down to the bottom. So there's a lot of variety going on in these habitats, which we've barely begun to explore. And these sedimented areas are turning out to be very rich in biodiversity, numerous new species, low density, low abundance, but a lot of diversity, which we're only just beginning to appreciate now. More spectacularly, given that they're actually occupying a smaller area, have had proportionally more investment in terms of their study, are places like methane seeps that I'll come back to and hydrothermal vents, deep sea cold water reefs. These are not the normal reefs that you're familiar with that need sunlight to grow. There are deep sea coral reefs, particularly off the coast of Norway and off the northern coast of the US. There are deep sea canyons that often have a remarkable life because they have hard substrates, which things like sponges and corals will want to stick onto, and vast areas of sponge reefs. And these also generate large amounts of animal diversity. And the one I'll highlight just now is in terms of how little we've looked at are seamounts. So every black dot you can see here represents a seamount. And what I can show you, though, and the colours that are about to come up show you about something about whether we visited them or not. The black dots that you see in the next part are where we still haven't been. The large dots of colour represent at least we have some information, but really it's the vast minority. There are over 14,000 seamounts that we're aware of, and we've barely begun to study them. So there's a huge job yet to be done on seamounts. But the area that I've mainly worked on personally in terms of the deep sea are these things called reducing ecosystems, where you have, for various reasons, either because organic matters come from the surface or that you get chemicals coming out of the crust, you'll end up with sulfates, or methane, that various kinds of bacteria can utilize. Now, these habitats are all well beyond the realm of the sun. They're down deep. The energy that is down here was once derived from the sun, if it's detritus that's flowed down to the bottom, or it's coming directly out of the crust, as is the case with hydrothermal vents. But even so, that drives bacterial communities that then drive large animal communities. So we get big, large amounts of biomass. Much more than we find on the deep sea plains. And so we have hydrothermal vents that I'm showing you here, which were first discovered only in the 70s in terms of the life that are there at the Galapagos Rift hydrothermal vents. Then we have methane seeps, which were only discovered off Florida in 1984. Wood falls, there's a lot of wood falls to the bottom of the sea. It comes out of rivers, it gets saturated and falls down, and there are amazing communities of animals that are waiting, bacteria and animals that are waiting for these wood parcels to fall to the bottom. And then most recently, we have whale falls that were only first discovered I think it's 87, not 89. My real interest is in whale falls, although I do have an interest in methane seeps, and I'll talk about both of these now. So the first whale fall, pieces of whale had been dredged up for years. In fact, the ear bones of the whales are the most resistant things that they have, and these had been hauled up by trawlers for some years. It was first noted that there was a submersible diving actually here off California came across a whale carcass. And this was by Craig Smith, who was led by Craig Smith in 1989, documenting the discovery of this whale carcass. And Craig Smith then really began a whole research career of actually sinking whales and watching what happened to them over time. Because what you have is a whale dies, sometimes they wash up on shore, and if you want to see what not to do with a whale carcass that washes up on shore, go to www.explodingwhale.com. And if you do want to see what should happen to a whale, it's tie a rope around it, tow it out to sea and sink it, because there's a huge community of animals and bacteria that are waiting for these carcasses as they fall to the bottom. Now, my colleagues up at Monterey Bay Aquarium and Research Institute found a whale carcass back in 2002, and ever since they've been regularly sinking whales off Monterey. And so here's Moss Landing where Umbari is, and there's a wonderful canyon that extends out from Moss Landing. And the first whale carcass was discovered by accident, and we nickname our whale carcasses. So this is Ruby, and Ruby was called Ruby because it was bright red. And whale bones on the bottom, you don't expect to be bright red. This is the skull of the whale, And what they notice, and it's a little bit difficult to see here, but you'll see it in subsequent pictures, is that the jawbone of the whale here was covered with these red plumes, much like the red plumes you saw at the beginning of the talk. And basically the whole whale was effectively red, like covered with a shag pile carpet. And that whale was at 3,000 metres depth, so it was right down near the bottom of the canyon. And here you can see the ROV Tiburon had picked up this rib, and here you can see these amazing red plumes that are coming out of the bone, and in fact they were eating away at the bone. This is where I got involved with the story, and because of my reputation as a worm person, I got sent these worms to look at, and I was certainly mystified when I first came across them. What we found was when you dissected open the worm, this was the plumes that you could see out. They had a long trunk, and then most of the body of the worm was down in the bone. And this sac here was actually an ovary, and then they had roots going down, extending out. Everyone was different. Everyone grew their roots in their own special way, and those roots were full of bacteria. So here's a picture of one dissected out. Here's all of the bone, and here you can see these roots, these green structures branching out through the bone. Now, it turns out that the bacteria in those roots were responsible for breaking down the whale product. And what they were breaking down was actually the collagen of the bone. So whale bone is made up of largely fats, but also there's a collagen matrix around which the calcium phosphate of the bone is deposited. And so that source of protein was really locked up. Whale carcasses were thought to last for many, many years while they slowly were maybe attacked by the bacteria. But what Ozidax does, which is the name of these worms, os is bone and edax is devour in Latin, is to get in there and open up the bone. And then the bacteria with the roots are actually dissolving the collagen. And then the worms eat the bacteria. So it goes from the collagen of the bone goes to the bacteria, and then the bacteria are digested by the bone, by the whale rather, excuse me. So here we have the whale bone would be out here. This is the surface of the roots, the epidermis of the worm. And inside the worm are these special cells. And you can see one here with an electron microscope. And here are clearly bacteria that are filling up these cells. So somehow, and we're still working on this in my lab, is we're trying to understand how, one, the worm must dissolve the bone. Bone is incredibly hard. So they're producing an acid, we think, to dissolve the bone. And then they're breaking down the collagen and transporting it through to the bacteria, which can fully digest it for them. And they then in turn digest the bacteria. Now, what are these amazing worms called Ozidax? Well, as it turns out, their closest relatives are these amazing creatures called, commonly called hydrothermal vent tube worms, or giant hydrothermal vent tube worms, which can reach about this tall, well over 2 meters high. And these, like Ozidax, share symbiotic bacteria. So Riftia uses symbiotic bacteria to break down hydrogen sulfide that's coming out of hydrothermal vents. And so we did what we do in my lab is to try and understand the evolutionary relationships of animals. So the yellow here is where Ozidax lies, and the pink here are their closest relatives, and that's these hydrothermal vent worms of Riftia, called Riftia. Now, as it turns out, we initially found two species of Ozidax, and as we've kept our studies going, we've sunk whales at various depths in Monterey Canyon, so we have them at 380 metres all the way down to 3,000 metres. And as it turns out, there's a species flock of Ozidax in Monterey Canyon. There are actually 16 different species just in that canyon alone. Scientists in Japan have now discovered Ozidax, scientists in Sweden have found them, and I've heard they've now been found in Antarctica. And one was seen on by a flyby by an oil rig ROV off Manus Island, off New Guinea. So it really seems like they're a worldwide group. But it's extraordinary to us to think that we have so many just in Monterey Canyon, and so we still have 13 of these to name. The thing, and I'll come back to that diversity in a minute, but I just want to point out that the traditional thought of whale carcasses was that they were long-lasting. That a whale carcass is basically a bit like detritus coming from the surface, if you want to be brutally blunt. It's not. It's like 10,000 years of gentle rain of plankton suddenly falling to the bottom, but it's in one vast lump of meat and bone. And the bone, though, while the flesh was stripped by sharks and hagfish very quickly, The bone was thought to last for many, many years, 60, 70, 100 years, while it was gradually degraded. But here's our original carcass, Ruby, 2004, and in 2007 it was basically gone. And we really think partly this is responsible to sediment because it's not that far offshore, but we really think Ozodax, with those roots, is opening up the bone, it softens it up, and then crabs get in there and they just tear it all apart and the bone goes. And this is actually ecologically important because it's the cycling of the whale is happening much faster. The recycling of the carbon of the whale goes back into the ecosystem much faster because of Ozodax than we originally thought. So ecologists are going to have to reconsider the role of whale falls in ecosystems and the deep sea in the future. Now, I do want to tell you something cool about Ozodax. And one of the things we started to think was when we first found all of these different Ozodax was, well, what did they evolve with? What were the first bones that they ate? We've only found them on bones. We have found them on cow bones in addition to whale bones. But what you can do with, this is an evolutionary tree of Ozodax, and you can take these branches that represent the splits between the different species of Ozodax. And this is representing molecular sequence data. So we use DNA to reconstruct our evolutionary trees. And you can argue that molecular sequences, DNA sequences, change at a clock-like rate. So then, if you get these branches and you can somehow estimate how fast that clock is ticking, you can say, okay, that group is X million years old. And we could actually go all the way back and say, okay, here's the origin of Ozodax. How many million years ago was that? Now, if we use, the trouble is, it's difficult to calibrate these clocks. So I'm going to show you two results. And one is this is a clock that is calibrated based on a traditional way of how fast a particular gene might be changing. This bar at the bottom starts at the Eocene about 50 million years ago. And here is the origin of Ozodax here, which actually is in the Oligocene. So this suggests that Ozodax evolved well after the origin of whales. Whales evolved here, the first whales. So this is something like Basilosaurus, which used to roam around in shallow waters off what is now Pakistan. And was quite big, though. It reached up to 18 metres long. And there were many antecedents of this particular kind of whale that were running around or splashing around about 50 million years ago. And then the argument from this particular clock would say that Ozodax evolved to eat mammal bones and probably to eat whale bones. However, there's another clock that we can use, and now we suddenly have the origin of Ozodax is well back before the Cretaceous extinction event. Now, the Cretaceous extinction event was what knocked out things like plesiosaurs and mosasaurs. All the way through this period here of the Cretaceous, there were huge swimming reptiles roaming the oceans. There were no whales. There were big fish. There were big reptiles. And they were all nailed at this line here, the brown line here. But the origin of the whale, that is pretty much coincident. In fact, Ozodax would have appeared about 70 million years ago on this clock. And the whales didn't appear until about here, 50 million years ago. So the implications from this clock are that Ozodax evolved to eat plesiosaur bones and mosasaur bones. So there are some paleontologists now looking at the bones of these creatures trying to find the traces. Ozodax makes very distinctive holes to see if they can find what it was eating. Okay, now I've left out the story of the males, and I want to quickly touch on them because all of those things you've seen so far, all the pictures were female Ozodax that had this big ovary and they were eating the bone. The males actually don't eat the bone at all. They live here. This is a female Ozodax. And the male Ozodax are tiny little things that are living in the tube, and you can see a series of males up close to the female there. And this is a blown-up picture of a male. So whereas a female can be about this tall, about 5-6 inches tall, a male in this species never gets to be over a millimetre long. So the females are thousands of times bigger than the males. And it gets better. The females can actually have harems of males. They can have 600 males at a time. So that when this hit the press, you can imagine the bloggers were loving this story. So what's going on? Well, we've worked on this for a while now, and here's a harem of males. I'm not kidding. These females can really have a lot. The male are always clustering. The female's trunk, this leads out to her plume over here. This is her oviduct. This goes back into the bone where her ovary is. And the eggs travel up this tube and then out to the outside water. So the females are spawning their eggs out into the water, and the males like to sit on top of that oviduct. So we think somehow where the males are sitting is what has to do with fertilization, though we haven't figured out where fertilization happens yet. But what we have figured out, pretty much that we're sure of, is that babies, when they're swimming around in the water, and each female makes hundreds of babies every day, most of them will die. But occasionally one will find a whale carcass. There aren't many whale carcasses on the bottom. But if that carcass is bone, and like the hagfish have stripped off all the flesh, and there's bone available, the baby will land on the bone and that will become a female. But fairly soon, and as you've seen from the video, the bones are covered with Ozodax females. Their plumes are out and they're obscuring the bone. And of course they want to do that. They don't want other competitors coming in to land on that bone. They want to eat it, not others. So what happens with those new incoming ones is that they are larvae that the females take, and they put them in their tubes, and they, we think, use a hormone and switch them to become males. And we've got various lines of evidence to support this, and even looking inside a female's tube, this is a baby. He's got lots of yolk, but as he develops, his yolk turns into sperm. He never develops a mouth or any of the system that the females develop. They put all their energy into making sperm. And then we think they die, so because the female can't feed them. Many messages and many lessons there. So what's great about submersibles is they have fantastic cameras these days. And this is Mbari's submersible camera, where we sat right down next to the carcass, and I thought we should see these things spawning. So we held the camera up close, and we did indeed see Ozodax females spawning their eggs out into the water. That was that white stream coming out there. And you'll see it again. And then the wretched rat-tailed fish came and sat in front of the camera. They liked the lights. And it really sat there for the whole of the spawning event. So we were lucky, really, to get as much as we did. But here you can clearly see a string of eggs going off into the water. And we think, on this one, we think there might be hundreds, if not thousands, every day, because this is a big species. We've actually brought other Ozodax back to my lab just down the hill at Scripps, and here you can see bone very clearly, and here's a female. Her oviduct is this white line here, and you can see the thread of eggs and that stream of eggs coming out. And what's great is we were then able to suck those eggs up, and we've been able to study the development of Ozodax over a period of weeks, and we found this is a swimming stage or an early swimming stage of Ozodax. And they swim around like this for a couple of weeks. So that's the window of time that they have to find a bone. After that, they're gone. They can't live. So they're little projectiles that the female sends out there, hundreds every day, in the hope that they will find another carcass. And here's a plot. We've been, Nerida Wilson and I spent long hours counting every egg, or averaging out every egg every day. And so over a period of 7 days, we ended up with an average of between 300 and 400 eggs being spawned per female per day. So their fecundity is very, very high. So life isn't that good for them, for the girls. They've got their tough side of it too. Okay, so that's my Ozodax story. Now we'll shift to my second story, which is about methane seeps. And methane seeps are extraordinary places because they're usually areas that are close to continental margins. And this is areas where there might be oil seeping up, petroleum seeping up, or there could be have ancient kelp falls or other terrestrial detritus has fallen down to the bottom. And it ends up producing large seepages of methane. And I'm sure many of you have heard about these methane seeps being a potential issue. A lot of them are frozen at the moment. And if the world continues to warm, we might get a vast methane burp. And methane is a terrible greenhouse gas, and who knows what effect that might have on global temperature. Now, you'll be happy to know that there are animals and bacteria down there that are doing their best to get rid of the methane for us. And here are mussels, for instance, that have got symbiotic bacteria living in their gills. And the bacteria, through a complicated process, are actually it's called anaerobic methane oxidization, that actually then allows sulfide degrading bacteria to degrade sulfide, and then in turn the mussels break down those bacteria and eat them. So it's a complicated process. But one of the outcomes is that of this anaerobic methane oxidization is that calcium carbonate precipitates out of the seawater and makes rocky reefs. Now, most methane seeps are soft sediment bottoms, and they have a particular community of animals living with them. And the reefs, though, provides a hard substrate, a new kind of place for animals to settle down, but no one had been there. So Lisa Levin and myself and collaborators at Caltech and Indiana University wrote a proposal to look at carbonated methane seeps off the west coast of the Americas. And one place we focused on here is Costa Rica. And the cruise I'm going to tell you about is CROCS, Costa Rica Rocks, 2009. And also we're going to be looking up at Oregon. And I just want you to note and I'll come back to this, the proximity of this is actually not too far away from hydrothermal vents of the East Pacific Rise system and also the Galapagos Rift here where the first hydrothermal vents were discovered. And I'll come back to that link later on. But first I want to show you is what we've been using to explore that with, and I'll revisit now technology. And here is the process of an Alvin launch, of how Alvin is deployed. Alvin's mothership is the Atlantis. It's a UNOLS vessel. The UNOLS fleet is part of what Scripps's fleet of ships belongs to. It's a national fleet, but the Atlantis is a Woods Hole vessel. And there's a special hangar on Atlantis for Alvin. So every day, Alvin comes up and is put away, looked after by a crew who get her ready for the next day's dive. And is lowered over the side. Technically, it should be a she, but it's named after a man, Alan Vine. So, I think even if ships are named after a man, we still call them she, so maybe it is a she. So we then lower it over the side. People go in through the hatch here, and there is actually a sphere, a titanium sphere that you go down in. All the rest is basically ballast, propulsion units. At the front, there's arms to pick up things and boxes to put specimens inside. And so what you saw here was a fantastic view of what it's like to go in the some of the clearer areas of the Pacific where the ocean is incredibly clear. And here you can see the sun, and we could still see light as we were going down several hundred meters deep, whereas if you went offshore from California by 100 meters, it would be black as pitch. But in the clean, they're clean waters off here as well, but areas where there's very little phytoplankton, where they're nutrient-poor seas, basically, they're deserts. The light penetrates incredibly deep. So here's a mock-up of Alvin. Takes three people, a pilot and two observers, two scientists, and there are portholes on each side, but the main porthole is for the pilot to look out and manipulate the robot arms and to pick up specimens. And there are lights and cameras to collect things, and it's all run on batteries, so it's not connected to the ship at all. Once the batteries run out, the lights go out, time to go up. And usually it's between, you go down at 8, come up at 5. So it's a normal working day. At the end of the day, the two lucky ones, the two lucky scientists who've been down get to come out. The other scientists who didn't get to go down that day are busily waiting, gossiping on the back deck. Usually that's the only time during the day when they've got any time to talk. And then all the specimens are unloaded, then into the lab, and Atlantis has a fantastic big lab where you can work. And then you spend all night working on the specimens, digging them out, photographing them, and then you start all over again the next day. So it's fantastic fun, and we spent 2 weeks doing this off the Costa Rica margin in February and March this year, and 13 Alvin dives worth of specimens. So what happened to those specimens? Well, we collected many of them. There were bacteria collected. There were forams, single-celled little protists were collected, but numerous invertebrates. And the bulk of those are here at Scripps, and they're ours. They're a part of the Scripps invertebrate, benthic invertebrate collection. We photographed most of them on board. We preserve them for taxonomy. We're sending them out to people all over the world, the experts who know how to name these things, because I don't know crabs from shrimps. And so we just find the people that can do this for us. The worms, they're mine. But the crabs and the shrimps, they're gone. We've also, of course, left them with our Costa Rican collaborators. So any species that end up being named through here, we send what is called the most important specimen. The holotype goes back to a museum in Costa Rica, But we will keep representative specimens here at Scripps. And here's a basic view of what we're seeing at the methane seeps. They're dominated by bacteria, free-living bacteria, which are breaking down the methane and the sulfide, but also large stands of these bestimentifera. So these are giant tube worms related to Riftia that I told you about a little bit earlier. But big stands like this of this bestimentifera and have otherwise only been seen in the Gulf of Mexico. There were also fantastic mussels and wonderful clams, and they were the three animals that really dominated the ecosystem. But there were many, many other smaller animals in amongst these stands. But really, the most spectacular thing was to see these huge stands of lamellibrachia, which can be this tall. And these, as I explained before, are breaking down sulfide. So they're big worms whose body is completely full of bacteria that they're feeding the bacteria, in this case sulfide, and then breaking down those bacteria. So here's a colleague of ours, Eric, and he's holding up a specimen there. There's the actual worm dissected out. It was well over 2 meters tall. Here's a specimen of the actual rock that we bring up. It's definitely a very hard carbonate rock with a representative mussel attached to it, and then one of those tube worms. And here's a clump of the tube worms that are attached to the rock. So what have we ended up with so far from this collection? Well, we know that we have three new species of these mussels. We think we have several new species of clams. We have various new species of worms, I'm very happy to say. And we think we have new species of those special crabs. The worms focus here. They're copepods. We have lots of new species of limpets. These are really a pain because we can't tell them apart at sea. So we photograph them and then we have to preserve them and actually sequence their DNA to figure out what they are because they all look the same to us. One of the most special things, though, is this thing that's called the Yeti crab. The first one was found off the East Pacific Rise hydrothermal vents back in 2005. But the Yeti crabs are really cool. They have these special appendages all over their arms and no one really knew what they were for. But we now know that these appendages are covered with bacteria and the bacteria that are breaking down the methane. And every now and then, the bacteria are wiped off by the mouth of the crab. So the crab has special parts on its mouth that scrape these hairs, scrape the bacteria off the hairs. And why are they waving their arms? Because it's to give the bacteria more methane. So they spend their whole lives waving their arms and every now and then stop and lick their arms clean. And they seem to congregate in areas where there's probably good methane flow coming out, bubbling up through the sediment. So this is the Yeti crab. The formal name is Kiwa, and this is a new species that's being described by one of Scripps graduate students, Andrew Thurber. So one of the other very exciting things about this place was that there were gigantic microbes. So there were huge bacteria. So these are bacteria that are over a millimeter across. You could see them with your eye. And they're breaking down the sulfide. And those were the sulfur granules, are the white spots that you can see inside the bacteria. Now, we were intrigued, some of us who work on embryos, because when we saw these, you can actually see that the bacteria go through cleavage divisions. And if you know your embryology, you'd actually might be thinking, gee, that looks like an embryo, an early cleaving animal embryo. The trouble is it's pretty big. It's about a millimeter across. Well, it turns out that in nature and science over the last few years, there have been what have been called fossilized early embryos published. And there were vast numbers of these animal embryos being published, and it was a little bit confusing as to what these were. And it now looks like, following a discovery in the Gulf of Mexico and then what we found here, that these might actually represent not embryos, but they're just giant fossilized bacteria that look like embryos. So there's a bit of a red face going on in a certain university that shall remain nameless, but it's number one often. Okay, apologies to anyone who went there. So back to the Costa Rica margin. The other reason we're interested in it is that it's very close to the hydrothermal vents of the Galapagos Rift and also the East Pacific Rise. And when we look at the animals that are there, we see noted similarities between the animals at seeps and the animals at vents. Not everything is the same. And we're really interested in whether the animals that are living at these seeps might be able to one, go and live at vents, or two, whether vent animals might be living at seeps. And we've actually found one of our mussels that we found when we were sequencing it. I told you there were three new species, but one of the mussels we found was definitely a mussel that is related, most closely related. It's to the species that occur out here on the East Pacific Rise. So we've definitely got evidence of connectivity between vents and seeps, which has not been posited very much before. And we're looking now through our DNA sequences to find more evidence of this connectivity. Okay, I'm going to shift now and finish up with a new discovery that was published just recently. And there, we're going into the other realm of the deep. I've been concentrating on the deep sea bottom, the deep sea floor, but I'll just finish up now with actually what's the biggest habitat in the sea, which is the deep sea itself. And so this is a wonderful worms called green bombers and their friends. And this diagram that was done by my postdoc, Karen Osborne, shows you the distribution of the deep sea in a proportional way. And so here's the very depths of the sea down in the Challenger Deep. These deep sea areas, the deepest parts below 4,000 metres, are a fairly small proportion of the overall deep sea, but the vast bulk of this area is called the Bathy Pelagic, and that's that area between 1,000 metres and 4,000 metres. And that's our least explored area. We can run nets through it, and we've picked up a lot of different things, but nets, as I told you before, get smash up the creatures very badly. So it's been a real boon to studying these creatures by using ROVs to get down there and look at what's going on. Now, Karen and I, and we'd been talking about Karen work with me for a while, this video came online a few years ago from an oil rig ROV that happened to pick up this shot. And there was, you know, it was being posted around the web for a while, what is this thing, what is this thing? And Karen and I didn't say anything because we knew what it was. But we had a project going, so we didn't talk about it. And when Karen first arrived, we worked on this thing. This thing's called Floater. It's one of the better names in taxonomy because it really reflects what it does. It's a magnificent worm that's about this big. It's completely transparent, and it can swim. It's got wonderful swimming appendages, these bristle-like things that are paddles that it can use for swimming. But its relatives, and this is an evolutionary tree of where this creature, Floater, lies, and the grey line you can see there takes us back to where it's descended from. And all of these different animals that you can see here are bottom-dwelling worms. So Floater evolved from a bottom-dwelling sea worm. And in fact, another one up there is actually another floating one called Poibius, which is even more weird-looking than Floater. And it actually independently evolved from bottom-dwelling worms. So we had, in this particular group, which is called Flabellagerity, we had two instances of the evolution of pelagic worms from bottom-dwelling ancestors. Now, Karen and I were intrigued by this, and because Karen had really intended to study this magnificent worm here, which you can see in this video, which she had been picking up over numerous years when she was working at Monterey Bay Aquarium and Research Institute on another group of animals that comprised her PhD. And Karen came to work with me on these creatures. You can see that they swim with this amazing sinusoidal action, and they have appendages off their body that effectively are oars. What's really very interesting about them is that they have these structures at the front, which we think are used for feeding, but then just behind the head, they have these little balls, these little spheres. Karen also noted that there was sometimes aggregating behavior. These things were often found together. We have no explanation for this. In fact, when you look at a couple of them, they almost seem to be mirroring each other. They're so swimming in such synchrony. When we looked very closely at these, we looked at them with comparative anatomy and also with DNA. And what we found was that there were a series of these animals that we've picked up from various places, mostly off California and Oregon, but one even in the far West Pacific, which is this one here. Now, some of them had very long appendages off their heads. And these were definitely gills. They are used for breathing. And their bottom-dwelling relatives have these as well. But some of them don't have the gills. They have these little balls. And when these balls are detached, which happens very easily, and the gills also detach very easily, they start to glow bright green. So that's where the nickname green bomber came from. Here you can see green bombs that haven't been detached. And here you can see one where the bombs have been detached. Now, they're not glowing here. This is actually, they're being illuminated by fluorescence, and so they're fluorescing green. They're not glowing green because we didn't have the camera technology to pick that up. But nevertheless, these balls, when they're attached, don't glow, but when they are detached, they do glow. And our current working explanation is that they're used for distraction of the predators. So these live, and well below 1,000 meters, so they're all living in the darkest depths of the ocean. There's no light down there, except for other animals that produce light. And so we think these green bombs are produced as a distraction to get the predators away, and that if you go and harass these, they drop the bombs, and then you've got these little glowing spheres, and the worm can then swim safely away. Not that we've seen that, but that's our hypothesis. Okay, so where do they fall? Well, they're actually in the same area as Floater and its other relatives, but as it turns out, they're in this green part of the tree. Floater was actually over here in the evolutionary tree, and Poibius, that other one I told you about, is that blue line there. So we now have one group, two groups, and three groups that have independently evolved from bottom-dwelling ancestors. And in fact, the purple line points out where the evolution of bombs occurred, and all of these other groups... part of this pelagic group, and all of these groups out here have those gills, long filamentous gills that are easy to break off. So we think the bombs evolve from gills. Okay, so that's the swimmer story. I'm going to wrap up now, but I want to tell you first a little bit about the Scripps collections and one of the initiatives that we have going. And that is what that is, and as I've made clear, one of the jobs that I have is to name new species. And so we spend quite a bit of our time naming new species. Not a lot of our time, because you don't actually get a lot of funding to name species. We usually do it in the course of our other work. If we did name species all of our time, we wouldn't get any grants. So, in fact, unfortunately, naming species doesn't get a lot of kudos. So we actually have a big backlog of things to name. Like I told you, there are 13 Ozodacs, for instance. So what we've set up, though, is that we are trying to prioritize naming these different species. And as part of that, we've got a Name a Species program of part of the collection. So the collections of some of you might have heard, we have four collection managers that look after the Scripps collections. They check on the alcohol, they catalogue the rocks, they sort the cores, they go out there and preserve everything. They keep the collection alive. So in addition to the four curators, we have these four essential staff members, the collection managers. Now, with recent budget cuts, these have all been put under the radar. I'm very happy to say our director, Tony Hamet's really a big fan of the collection, so it hasn't been a problem thus far. But we do have an endowment for our collections, and we are perfectly willing to name species after you, your friends, or anything that's polite, starting at $5,000. So if you are interested, it is on the Scripps website. Go to the collections part or the development page. You can name a new species. We have giant hydrothermal vent tube worms going. We have nudibranchs going. We have giant deep sea straw worms going. And as I said, we only name things in a nice way after someone. No slimy, wormy names for anybody. It's always done in good spirit. Some are gone. Yes. Sold. There are three names have been sold so far. But we have plenty more that are available if you're interested. Okay, I have many people to thank who helped me out in my work. I have the Ozodacs crew, people at Imbari, especially Bob Ryan, Hope, Nerida Wilson here at Scripps, Katrine Morsay over in Denmark. The swimmer crew is Karen, who's visiting here at the moment, but is a postdoc in the lab, Steve Haddock at Imbari, Fred Playle in Sweden, and Larry Maiden from Hui. So actually this project's really been a very big collaboration between the three major oceanographic institutes of the US. And then for our carbonates work, here's Lisa Levin, another professor here at Scripps, and the whole crew from the Atlantis crews back in March. And I'll be happy to take any questions. What is the biochemistry of the luminescence? We don't know yet. It's certainly not bacterial. It's not a luciferin luciferase as far as we know. So it's not an analog to anything that we know happening with some of the terrestrial luminescent systems. We have luminescence scientists working on it here on various kinds of luminescent worms at also up in Mbari, but it's still not being characterized. Is it possible to grow any of the animals in the lab? Ozodax, we've been fairly successful in keeping them in the lab, and we've had them spawn in the lab. We've had their babies grow and then develop until they settled, so we knew how long they lived. We haven't closed the life cycle, so that's one of the things we would love to have the Ozodax grow and recruit onto bone and then grow up on the bone. So that's one of our... We can keep them. The critical factor with culturing animals is temperature. So we're lucky enough here at Scripps to have temperature control. We can keep temperatures in our aquaria down to 3 degrees Celsius, which is pretty much as cold as the sea gets. And we don't control for pressure, and we don't control for oxygen, both of which are important. The pressure, of course, increases by 1 atmosphere every 10 meters of depth. Animals that are coming up from below 1,000 meters, below 100 atmospheres of pressure, are impossible to keep at atmospheric pressure in our tanks here. But animals up to 1,000 meters we've kept alive for several months. The oxygen is another matter. As you go deeper in the sea, we hit something called the oxygen minimum zone. So on a graph, you see oxygen gradually declining from the surface waters down to about 500 meters, and it varies where you are in the ocean. But below about 1,000 meters, the level of oxygen seems to rise again. So many of these animals that are coming up from 1,000 meters or less are actually coming from oxygen-deprived waters. So if we suddenly put them in oxygen-rich environments, their physiology might suffer, and that's one of the challenges we're trying to solve as well. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.